All right, so listen, there are no shortage of record labels out there. So if I was asked who I think stands out above the rest in quality and consistency, it's Convulse Records. Starting in only 2019, they have been completely unstoppable. You know them from releasing records by Gel, MS Paint, and Military Gun. Well, they've just released two new 7-inches, one by the Tokyo hardcore band The Breath, and the other by Ultras, who features members of World Peace and Fentanyl. You can check out those records, along with all the other top-tier releases, by visiting convulserecords.bandcamp.com. And if you want a personal recommendation, check out the Daisy release, Maximum Blast Super Loud. Past guests of the podcast, great band. Or how about Entry? Their latest 7-inch exit interview is incredible. And hey, it features Clayton from Touche Amore, and I swear I'm not being biased. Hit up convulserecords.bandcamp.com. Welcome to the first ever podcast. My name is Jeremy Bohm. I am your host. And if this is your first time here, this is a show where I interview artists of all kinds about the first experiences in their art form that led them to where they are today. This is episode 194. And my guest this week is, I'm just going to say it. He's my hardcore hero. This week, I'm talking to Chris Callahan. Chris has been in so many goddamn bands, and I'm going to be honest, I love them all. He's been in bands like Left 4 Dead, Ruination, The Swarm, aka Knee Deep in the Dead, Cursed, an all-time favorite, if not my favorite, Burning Love, Mature Situations. Recently, he did a band called Oxygen Tank. But most active in these last bunch of years is a band called Sect, which just announced a brand new album, which will be coming out on June 7th on Southern Lord Records. The record is called Plagues Upon Plagues. There's a single you could listen to. I believe it's on YouTube. I don't know if it's on Spotify yet. But Sect fucking rocks. It's members of Earth Crisis. It's members of Undying. It has Andy from Fall Out Boy on drums. And like most things, there's so many guests that I always want to have on the show, but I wait until they have something to announce. And when I saw the Sect news come up, I was like, it's time for me to get Chris on the show. And I loved this episode. I love this conversation so much. It's absolutely one of my favorites. It meant so much to talk to Chris. And I want to let you know, if you happen to be new here, that there is a bonus episode available right now where Chris answered questions that were submitted by subscribers. You can access that by finding the link in the episode description or by just simply going to patreon.com/thefirsteverpatreon. You can subscribe for any of those tiers and get access to that bonus episode, plus all of the other bonus material. Subscribe for just a little bit more, and you can submit questions to upcoming guests. There's a Discord channel, all sorts of fun stuff, contests. We do lots of things over there. It would mean a lot to get your support, and it's just a lot of fun. Another way to support is to subscribe to the show on Spotify, Apple, wherever it is you are listening to this, telling your friends, posting it in your stories. All of that stuff means a lot. Leaving a positive rating review, that always goes a long way. So just want to let all you know about that. And without further ado, we're just going to get right to it. Here is my conversation with the best, strongest, scariest, realest voice in hardcore. It's Chris Callahan. What's up, Chris? It is so nice to see you.
You too, Jeremy. Yeah.
Oh my God. So this is one of those interviews that I've been wanting to do for a really, really long time. And this is a common theme on this show because I'm up to almost 200 episodes, which is absolutely crazy.
Wow. But nice.
There's so many people that I always want to talk to, but I'm like, I want to wait for that person to all of a sudden announce something or whatever so that like it's beneficial for them too, as much as I know this is just two friends hanging out.
Yeah.
But obviously, a new Sect record is on the way.
It's a good excuse. So I saw that.
Yeah. And I said, time to message my man.
Hell
so
yeah.
Here we are.
I love it.
And I'm also excited because as much as I've been following so many of your bands since I found punk and hardcore and all of that, I know there's so much that I don't also know. Like, for instance, I actually don't know exactly where you are from. Is it Hamilton, actually, or is it like Toronto specific, or where are you from?
I was born here in Toronto. I grew up in Hamilton, which is like 45 minutes down the line, and moved back here in 1995 when I was about 20, 21. And
okay.
Since then, mostly I've been there and in Montreal a little while and a small university town here called Guelph. And otherwise, I've been here for like the last 25 years, basically, minus Montreal time.
So you have truly seen Toronto go through so many different changes.
Yes. And if you weren't here, like there's less and less people that have a before and after of the whole picture, you know? So I'm sure this probably makes a lot more sense to people that are younger or just newer, regardless of how old they are. But yeah, trying to just like, I'm still in my own old haunts, you know, like I'm still in those physical places and just trying to do the same thing. And it doesn't really always let you do that, you know?
Totally. What? I mean, next, you know what? I'll put a pin in that because we'll get to it, I'm sure. But the first question I usually ask musicians is, when you were growing up, what was the first thing that you connected with musically that felt like it was yours? Maybe not something that was being played in the house by parents or whomever you were being raised with, but something that you found to kind of give you a sense of identity.
Okay. I hate to get so dark right off the bat,
but I love it. Let's go.
The first thing that it actually like kind of stopped me and like, I had to like think about it. I'm turning 50 this year. So I was growing up in like the late 70s, early 80s.
Yeah.
And the first thing I can really remember, you mean like a song or a thing that, yeah?
Sure, yeah. Whatever it means to you.
And I know for sure this is the one because I can remember all these little particulars about it. I was like in a little weird pup tent of some kind on my lawn and I had an orange transistor radio. And it was the Boomtown Rats, "I Don't Like Mondays." Do you know that song?
Yeah.
Sounds weird, but a lot of the stuff that was like pop music, I don't know. At the time, things in the 80s were early 80s especially, and I think that maybe this is overthinking it, but I do feel like it's probably like that tail end of the Cold War that we're sort of seeing a resurgence of now. There was something in the water, even in pop music, and even as a kid, that was pretty sensitive to changes, and it had a lot of home situation was all kind of weird and moved a lot. And so I was really always like, I don't know, I think sensitive to the underlying vibe of things. And there's this Boomtown Rat song, "I Don't Like Mondays." And it's a true story of somebody that was 16 years old that basically a mass shooting by a teenager that went to a school and gunned a bunch of people down. And that was their explanation for it. It was like, I don't know, I don't like Mondays. But I don't know, like think about a lot of little things. As goofy as this sounds, like Rockwell, "Somebody's Watching Me," 99 Red Balloons. This is about the Berlin Wall. And like this, there's like something, even though you're really young, something about the adult world you pick up is like, something's not right with the world. And I don't know what it is yet because I don't understand these things, but something is really fucked up.
Right.
And that was the first song that was like, this is pop music on the radio, but I'm like, I guess it's a punk band, but that's the first thing that grabbed me. Like, whoa, these people know something's wrong and they could tell me what it is, you know? So
it's so fascinating. Like that, I can't think of many other eras either to where what is happening in the world has trickled into like, you know, pop music, right?
Sure.
That was basically pop music. And I can't think of, can you think of any other time
I think
where it's been like that?
Like the 60s to some degree. But really,
sure.
Nuclear things were hanging over. There really was a threat of war. It came really close. The Iron Curtain, Russia, all that. The U.S. versus Russia. Yeah, it's in everything of the time.
And just thinking about the consistent amount of war and conflicts, whatever, however people want to choose to describe them, that we've had since then, it's like you would think that it would trickle in more, but it's not. It always just gets considered counterculture no matter what. And that is like a fascinating thing to really think about.
Yeah.
Wow, man. So what was the first, were you buying vinyl at that age? Was it like 7 inches? Was it things like that?
Probably was LPs and cassette tapes at the time.
Okay. Yeah. I was curious what the first album that you remember maybe buying yourself that like you picked out at a record store.
All right. This is super not tough or cool at all.
I love it.
Did you have K-Tel or is that Canadian?
I think that's Canadian. What is it? Like a record store?
A budget brand of records that did all those kind of like mashups and best ofs that there'd be like TV commercials for.
Oh,
did you know the Mini Pops?
I don't know if I do.
They're like little kids singing like 80s pop songs.
Okay, so that's like these days would be like the Kids Bop sort of thing, where it's like the child, like the young kid rendition of like these songs that are popular.
Yeah. There was the Mini Pops, but then the same label was called K-Tel. They did a bunch of this just like candy that there'd be like, you know, those TV commercials with the scrolling things for. And there was one called Hit Express. And it was just like Journey, Don't Stop Believing, Tommy Two-Tone, 867-5309 Jenny, like Working for the Weekend, Rick Springfield.
It's
not the coolest story, but that's probably my first that I like went to a store. I'm like, I want that, and saved up all my like, you know, allowance or something and got.
Yeah, but something tells me though, Chris, that though you might, you know, like in the grand scheme of like, especially the music that you ended up falling into and all that sort of stuff, like would be quote unquote considered uncool. But at the same time, I'll bet you all of those songs still bang to you. You know what I'm saying? Like you could find enjoyment in at least some of those these days.
I absolutely could. Tommy Two-Tone especially. Yeah.
For sure. What about your first concert?
Okay. It was Heart.
Nice.
Yeah. It was Heart at this place. I don't know what it's called now. It was Cops Coliseum. You know how all like the arenas just change names? They're all like corporate things every 2 years. I think this is another thing about getting older. Like I'm not learning a new name every 2 fucking years. It's Cops Coliseum. It's probably like the Snapchat Center for the Performing Arts now or some shit. I don't know. But I saw that there and it wasn't like the cool 70s Barracuda Heart. It was like What About Love, kind of like heavy eyeliner 80s Heart. But they played all the hits. Yeah, that was the first concert I ever went to. Followed closely by The Cult, Electric.
That's which fucking was sick.
Yeah, that's a little more awesome. Because Ian Asbury, their singer, even though he's British, for some reason went to high school in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. And there was some kind of Hamilton cult connection.
I was going to say, like, did that become like a Hamilton Pride band? Sure, or was that like a you had to know? Oh, okay, cool.
Everybody really liked The Cult. Yeah. So I saw them and I think a really early Lenny Kravitz opened it.
Oh.
Yeah, like kind of unknown Lenny Kravitz. Because whenever year that came out, like 85 or 6 or 7.
Yeah.
Probably more like grade 7. I wouldn't. Yeah. Yeah.
Were you seeking out to go see Heart or was that like family bringing you or something or friends?
No, my mom was really, really uncool. We had Boney M. The Beatles, which is just probably the reason I hate the fucking Beatles. Boney M, which is like the Jamaican kinky sex ABBA. They're fucking awesome. Yep. I still think Boney M's pretty cool. Not a lot. Nana Mouskouri, weird French stuff. She wasn't really, except for Leonard Cohen. That's one thing that she actually turned me on to, that she was like a hippie in the 60s here in Toronto. And she got to see him in like coffee house era. And a lot of people like that. So that was cool. But no, I don't remember how it went about with Heart. I think she probably would have had to like let me and help me out or take me there or something. But yeah.
Yeah. Damn. So I know you played drums or like at least in like from what I understand, like maybe the first iteration of Fucked Up. But like was drums the first instrument you ever played or did you ever play anything else?
No, it was. It was drums.
Okay. And when did you start playing?
Oh, yeah, I was in probably like the 8th grade, early high school. I think I just had a lot of like aggression issues and just like misfit loner kid. Yeah. So it helped. It just helped to like hit something.
For sure. Was the intro like through school? Was it like through like a school band situation or was it like, hey, parents, like I'd love to try to learn how to play drums and got like a cheap kit or something?
I think it was that. It was just my mom and me. So, I don't know. I remember I didn't have any cymbals and I moved schools a lot as a kid. So I had just fallen in. It was just like sit at the nerd table. I didn't have any good friends, but it's, I fell in with some people that became such dear friends and would later be like my first bandmates. And they were also just trying to survive and get through it too. And they liked, everybody liked AC/DC. So it was always like a lot of Back in Black would happen.
Nice.
But yeah, it was, there was literally an unfinished basement of this house on Hamilton Mountain. And there was actual pots and pan lids like dangling from things for cymbals. That's such an Oliver Twist bullshit story, but it happened that way. I wish it was cooler, but it wasn't. But yeah.
No, that's it's charming. It's incredibly charming that you know, what is the desperation creates innovation, you know?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
So, you know, it's funny. I recently just added a question to this, which I just realized I skipped. But as we were about to continue into the you learning to play drums, but what was your first band shirt? Was it Heart?
I didn't really have a lot of like music like clothes until really like punk and new wave things.
Okay. Do you remember any of those?
I went and I saw The Cure on the tour that was for Disintegration. Yeah. Which was called the prayer tour. Yeah. So it would have been like 89, 90. I know that was my first shirt, like that I bought from a band that I just like, had to tear it off me. And actually lately I went and found an old one, 'cause I always wished that I still had that. And I found like a reissue, a reprint of one and found
it. That's awesome.
Yeah. It was The Cure on Disintegration with a really like a pretty early Pixies. And Love and Rockets. Yeah, and the Pixies, there's just hardly anybody knew. And Love and Rockets opening. Yeah.
What a fucking show.
Yeah.
Was it a huge venue?
It was called the CNE here, the Canadian National Exposition. Like, it's a big expo outdoor band show. And it was a few years. I think I just lucked into the timing of what I was into in this moment for like a couple of years of shows. Because I saw Jesus and Mary Chain on Automatic within two summers. That Cure show and Depeche Mode on either Violator or 101. Yeah. So it was a pretty good run.
First
band shirt from like a merch table would have been that or Depeche Mode. And first one from like a head shop, there's a place called Rockin' Tees in Hamilton, was probably a Cramps Gravest Hits shirt.
Oh, nice.
And I remember because my drunkle Mike made fun of me at like Thanksgiving and said, "Cramps, what do you got, your period, boy?" I don't know why they tried to have to be so Southern about it, but yeah, it was just like, yeah, fuck you, Uncle Mike. Yeah, so
it's a perfect uncle joke.
For sure. Yeah.
So when you're starting to play drums, like you mentioned AC/DC, like, and I feel like that's like a really solid learning to play drums band, like if you're listening to that in headphones, because it's just so in the pocket, pretty like, you straightforward know, kick snare. That like what you were learning to
kind of that, yeah, like anybody could really try to do that. And and Bauhaus in terms of the first song, and this is like, if you think about it, it's like such a slow pitch, but like Bela Lugosi's Dead. It's just right, like, I could sort of mess around on a guitar and play it too, and a couple other Bauhaus things, because they were just so remedial and easy and fun and moody. So
yeah, but with that song in particular, it's like, because it, I mean, how long is that song? Like fucking 23 minutes or something,
but know? It just does like, this, doesn't change the whole 23 minutes.
Right, so like if anything, it becomes like, without maybe even realizing it, it's like it's at least giving you a sense of keeping tempo for a long
for
time.
Sure, absolutely,
you know. Yeah. So then what was the very first band that you did? And were you playing drums in the band?
No, when it actually happened that way, I was singing. Like, I guess in that formation, there was like a punk guy that went to our Catholic high school before I had to change high schools, that was like singing, and we made some punk songs. I don't even know if we ever had a name for what we did. But the guy kind of went AWOL and also sort of turned us towards a bunch of punk. But I ended up around hardcore just by friends of mine, like the freaky gothy people that were friends of mine. Someone, my friend Naomi, was dating my friend Zach, who would be my first kind of roommate outside of home. And he was like a straight edge guy and he loved everything. Like Integrity was pretty new then, but things like that, Neurosis, a whole lot. Judge, I don't know, steered me to a ton of things, but liked good kitschy old things in garage and stuff at the same time, like not a really typical hardcore kid at the time. So I don't know. We ended up playing in a band and it was called Basket Case. It was remedial, but I mean, who the hell, whose isn't when you're like 16, you know?
Yeah.
You got all this aggression to do something with and you're just trying to like aim it at the first thing you see.
I'm also, you know, shout out to you for having a not bad band name for your Thanks. First band. That could be a lot worse, you know?
Thank you. It could be worse.
So I'm kind of curious. So like, was your intro to finding all of that sort of stuff like by way of New Wave, where it was sort of like you're just noticing like similarities between New Wave and punk, and then that's kind of what steered you to finding all of this, or was it mostly through friends or what?
Honestly, at the time, like all the weirdos, and in a place that's a little bit violent and aggro, and if you're kind of like don't have a dad or big brothers or anything like that, and you're kind of on your own, you just gravitate towards like the outcasts. And the outcasts right. in general at that time were like the skaters and goths, which weren't even called goths yet. They were just like these freaky people with capes and shit. It was like, I don't know. Like I went to parties and people were like in the dark under a cape. Like,
right.
Here's to you. yeah, that punk kids, really everybody got, at least in this particular band of people, everyone, it was a mishmash of everything, you know, and like yeah. skateboarding especially, you know, tied it all together. So it totally. Wasn't a big stretch to like, to hardcore, just like heavier music, you know?
So in Basket Case, you're singing in the band.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And is it like, is there remnants of like what would become your, any of your later bands, or was it more like New York hardcore straight or like,
nah, melodic? I wasn't really like the New York toughness yeah. thing. And we were all too nerdy. We were too nerdy to pull that shit off anyway. We covered Commuter Man by DRI though.
Okay.
I don't know. It was just really, and the other guys were like my best friends and a lot, and still are a very little few people that I have that go back that far. And I think we're a little bit trauma bonded by the few years we all went through, and we were each other's kind of refuge from all the shit at home and school and whatever.
Right.
So it just was whatever we had to make it be, but I was definitely more towards hardcore than those guys were. So, It was kind of chuggy. It was kind of punky. Like it wasn't great, but I can't say I'm like embarrassed about it. I don't know. You got to start where you start, you know?
Yeah, that's, you know, better than most of us could say for a lot of our first bands, you know, if you're yeah. like, yeah, you know, it could have been worse.
What was yours?
Oh my God. I played guitar in, and tried to sing when I'm like a child, like a wow. genuine child. The band was hilariously called Victim of Atrocity. We're like a bunch of white kids from like suburban LA. It's like, what atrocities can we possibly have dealt with? And it was like, it was just three different people who liked three different kinds of music all yep. trying to, you know, so it was generic bad, I guess. I don't know. What was the first... Was this the band that you played your first show with?
Yep. Yeah.
Okay. And what was that? What was that like?
I guess we'd kind of be the odd band out, or the ones everyone was like being too nice to. Chris Logan from Chokehold, their singer. He's to this day a really good friend, and he was really supportive. And a lot of people were. So was Jeff Beckman that I would end up playing with. No, everybody was pretty cool about it. Like it just wasn't that good, but we played with did you ever know Slap of Reality? It was a band yeah. from maybe Florida, I think. They were the big yeah. touring band, but Slugfest, Vogel's band, because Buffalo and Hamilton were kind of sister cities across the border, and we'd go there a lot, and those kids would come up here a ton. So we were all like maybe 16, 17, and I'll say Vogel has been Vogel the whole time. he means it, man. That's his his real heart.
Was that the band that breathed fire?
No. What? The fire thing that happened?
I had him on the show last year, maybe longer than that. I can't keep track of time anymore, but fuck, maybe it was a Slugfest. He told me about one of his early bands, and it was like their shtick was they had a member that just would like, for no reason, breathe fire.
Whoa, that happened with this band, They Live, from Buffalo.
Oh, right.
Where Nation played with Tragedy and them in a loft apartment, and they did it, and this kid caught his face on fire, and it was really messed up.
Oh, but
fuck. That's a whole nother thing. But yeah. No, maybe I never knew that band of Scott's.
Yeah, I'll have to think about which one that was.
Yeah.
So do you remember, I mean, this is, you know, obviously it's a while back, but like, do you remember, were you excited? Were you ever someone who had stage fright? Like, did you have stage fright performing for the first time or anything?
I remember all of that show because it was just like, yeah, it felt really like a big deal. It was in the basement of a bowling alley. Chris Logan put it on. Chokehold played it too. And Support was the band, Garrett from Texas Is the Reason later on. His really, really earlier Buffalo band too. They played it.
Yeah.
And there was probably more that I'm forgetting on that bill, but yeah, I don't know. It was cool. I remember there was a trampoline. I remember I got blood all over my Clockwork Orange shirt to Slugfest. And I tried not to wash it. Yeah, it was like hard. No, it was cool, but sorry, what was that? What was the question again?
Would you mind being nervous and like, did you have stage fright, stuff like that?
I've never not to this day.
Really?
Yeah.
To this day.
Yeah. Four people in a basement or like 4,000 in a field. It's just like, I get nervous no matter what.
Is it because of anything that could happen? Is it because, do you think it's like just what could potentially go wrong, or is it just like people looking at you? What do you think? Have you thought about it like over the years? What the thing is?
I've tried to figure it out. I think maybe it's just insecurity and self-consciousness, but it's kind of like it's like a self-cleaning oven of anxiety. Like it defies everything about my personality that I should be able to stand up in a room in front of people and do something. But because I had so much, I just have to like kick out of my system and still kind of do. And that was the best therapy I've ever got. Then all I can do, anxiety or not, is like, well, you're fucking doing it, so figure it out. You know, it's like barrel through it. And usually the more nervous I get, the better it'll be the second it starts. And then just have to like fight to kind of like lose myself in it. You know?
Yeah, I was going to ask. I mean, you know, not to blow smoke, but like I've always found you to be such a fucking great front person for whatever band you've been in at the time. And like, when I was curious if like it's the lead up and then once you're on stage and doing it, do you feel it start to fall away once you're actually in the moment?
Totally. Okay. Yeah, it's the build up for sure. Those guys in Sect, they know now, like if I'm AWOL, I'm not like off down, like gone away, or I'm just like circling in orbit outside, you know, somewhere very nearby to just like stand up and start, because I kind of have to, I don't know, get around myself to do it usually.
Oh, yeah, it's like for me personally, like I don't really get, I just get really anxious to just get it, you know, to just start playing.
Yeah.
And I think my years of playing guitar in bands, I have a really hard time watching my band set up. I hate it because like I know that that's when things go wrong, when all of a sudden the bass amp doesn't turn on.
Oh,
all of a
sudden,
whatever. Yeah. You know, that thing. And so because I've been there, I can't watch it. So I'm like you, where I'm not near the stage until I have to be.
Yeah.
Usually.
I kind of sitting like, there, and then you're there for another 10 minutes, just kind of fumbling with your keys or putting your things in a pile or something. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Just like, just looking at your phone and being like, yep, I guess it's 60 more seconds have passed, I guess.
Yeah. You know? It's like, just tell me exactly when to start and we go. Yeah.
Exactly. What was the first band that you recorded with? Did that band record?
We recorded some kind of a demo in my mom's basement, and I don't remember the particulars of like who did it. It would have been like a 2 or 4 track recording of just for like a tape that we just made a handful of for our friends.
As a longtime record collector, I owe so much to distros. One-stop shops for getting the best releases from all my favorite labels in one place. That's where Devil Dog Distro comes in. Based in the UK and leading the charge in aggressive music for record collectors, they're the official home of Triple B, Daze, Asian Man, New Morality Zine, Iodine, Maggot Stomp, and they're even kind enough to carry releases from my label, Secret Voice Records. You can get 10% off your order by using the code FIRSTEVER, spelled out FIRSTEVER, at checkout when you visit devildogdistro.com. And if you're in the UK, you get free shipping on orders over £100. And if you're in the EU, you get free shipping on orders over £150. So visit devildogdistro.com and use the code FIRSTEVER to get 10% off your order. Do you want to know what my favorite record store is in this entire goddamn country? It's Wanna Hear It Records in Watertown, Massachusetts. You might say to yourself, what do I care? I live in Boise. I live in Fort Worth. I live in Los Angeles. What good does that do me? Well, I'll tell you. They have a fully operational web store that gets updated with incredible secondhand records every Wednesday. I myself have gotten into quite a bit of trouble every time they post what's available online. Not only are they very rare records, they are very reasonably priced. And if you have no interest in secondhand records at all, they also sell new records. And here's the exciting part. Listeners of the show get 10% off their orders. So if you check out, use the code FIRSTEVER, spelled together, one word, spelled out, FIRSTEVER, you get 10% off. And if you spend more than $100, you get free shipping. Head on over to wannahearitrecords.com and follow them on Instagram for updates. Username, wannahearitrecords. How many bands are between Basket Case and, like, say, Left 4 Dead? And were there, and like, how many, yeah, existed, zero, do you think, between there? Oh, none. So it went from that to that.
Yeah, went straight to that. I moved back to Toronto, like, the year after. Everyone was kind of going to college and university and work, and I moved back to Toronto. And then the year after, I had to kind of move to home. And, yeah, we took a road trip with Jeff and I to Atlanta to just hang out with a bunch of people. Jeff J, Jock, if you know Jock. Do you know Jeff?
Like, he's... Jock Records, like, yeah. J-A-W-K?
Yeah. Yeah, we went to see them, Ken Tufor and people like that all lived in this big spot with a half pipe in it. And it was when the Olympics, it must have been 96, because it was that bombing, the Unabomber Olympics.
Oh, right.
Yeah, and I think in the course of this road trip, we had figured it out, and we made, like, somebody worked at a Kinko's and we made all this Left 4 Dead stuff in the middle of the night for free, and made all these things. So yeah, we got that going pretty much once we got back. But by that time, really, like, a lot of, like, the scene around Hamilton, people had kind of dispersed. It was very kind of, what seemed really big was really turned out to be sort of momentary. And there was about a dozen people that were kind of the core group. So we were really just doing that to amuse ourselves. Like, we didn't know that it wasn't all kind of over, you know?
Right.
So it was just, wow, us and some of our friends and people being obnoxious for our own amusement, really. But yeah.
So because you had been playing in this band and, like, I'm assuming, like, participating in, like, that area of Ontario, like, when you moved back and then Left 4 Dead started, was it with people that you had already known for a while?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
For sure.
Got,
yeah,
it. Got it.
Well, it started with me. What?
No, please, please go.
Okay. I know. Me and Jeff hung out in one particular afternoon, and we just watched movies all the time, watch horror movies, watched a bunch of Texas Chainsaw and a bunch of, like, Reservoir Dogs and shit that was really good to us. And we went in his basement, where his parents' basement, where Chokehold used to jam on Matt's, his brother's drums. And him and I just wrote pretty much the whole discography in, like, a day or so. It was just like,
are you cool, serious?
Wicked. Next bar. All right. Next. I was drumming, but it was just to kind of write them. And then, yeah. And then Matt and Josh, it was like three quarters Chokehold when we started, but it wasn't really what those other guys other than Jeff were into. So our friend Phil, who passed away after, played bass, and our friend Curtis played drums. Yeah. So that was the first band that recorded.
Not to get in the weeds of this stuff, but this is just me being, like, a fan of that. I'm just curious, like, because there's that cassette that has a bunch of the songs, and then it seems like maybe those songs got split into, like, the Acrid split and the 7-inch split, right? Is that kind of what? Yeah,
I think so, because I think we only recorded twice back then in the same place. And I remember because we got another guitarist on the stuff that was like the Ochre things. This guy Joel Fisher, who plays in a band called Absolute. He played the reunion shows with us. And he had a bunch of these just like really like scum punk string bends. He was a really good addition, but I don't think he was the first recording. So I think it was just the second. So I think we did it twice in the same. It was. Do you want to know about the recording stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Please.
It was in. It felt like a halfway house. Hamilton.
Is this Ben Tilt?
Yeah. Oh man, you've done. You did your homework. Yeah.
Man named is it Dan Zivakovic?
Something like that. Dan from Blue Tilt is all I ever knew. Yeah, he was out of his mind, and kept trying to tell us about this pen that the astronauts took to outer space. We called it Cat Piss Studios because it smelled. It was a basement of an old house that I think may have actually been like a halfway house or had different people living in it. And this guy, it was like, it was very, it was kind of Silence of the Lambs, which really lent itself well to what we were doing. And I don't know. We just did it. Print that. Cool. Good enough. Next one. Go. So that's kind of what it feels like. That's what it was like. We just did it good enough for hardcore.
What's it? It sounds like it was recorded live. Was it?
It Do you may remember? Have
Or is it track been? By track?
I don't remember, but it was pretty much like a lot. It wasn't elaborate. It was only a few tracks. I think. So it could have been, or like all this stuff.
Yeah. Cause
the vocals.
Cause the energy, I think it's more so like the energy sound of it does sound like, I wouldn't be surprised if the music was tracked all together.
I think
like the vocals were just done separate.
Yeah. It does kind of sound like we're all just standing right there as we do it. I think that's what it was. I could be wrong, but I think that's true.
Where do you land these days? Kind of a similar question to like stage fright stuff. Like, where do you land these days when it comes to recording? Are you someone that enjoys the process, or does it depend band to band?
Also on the self-consciousness tip, nothing in the world sounds more mortifying than hardcore vocals in a room with nothing else actually happening other than through your headphones. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I'm in the middle of recording an album as we speak. The isolated hardcore vocals is a circle of hell.
Oh my God. And I have to like blow off the cobwebs first. So there's always a bunch where like, ooh, is this going to be it? And then I get stressed out if it's crackly or shitty. And like, I have to, for my voice, at least I never learned or wanted to learn how to do it any other way than just to fucking actually shriek, you know, just push more. It starts to go push even harder. You taste blood, push more, and that's it.
If I don't have the most debilitating headache by the end of that song, then I've done it wrong.
For sure. Ice cream headaches are real. And then I do the real, like, the real go for it growly ones when it's all in the can. Just like, well, fuck it. Let's just blow this thing the rest of the way out. Yeah.
So that makes me, you know, so... Knowing that there is that level of self-consciousness in it, when I think of a band like Burning Love, where like you're more so singing than I think any of the other projects you had done at that point, how was that experience for you going into it? Was that something that you knew you could pull off, but like were intimidated to do ever, or what was the vibe there?
I don't know. I always wanted to tell myself I was doing something super different this time, and then it would be like 5% different or so. So Burning Love was also coming out of Cursed being a pretty fucking negative overall experience from the inside, at least. And trying to do something that was like intentionally not so dark, like just like for fuck's sake, I'm just playing like a punk band that feels like fun. And it very quickly routed back to like intense, because I think that's just like that's what that vent is for, you know? No, it's no failure of it. It's just like it's kind of an abuse of a medium to just do bullshit, you know, when there's so much to get off your chest and so much to like talk about. So it very quickly got more serious, but I don't know, in terms of the singing, I've got a long history of sending all my bandmates out for like burritos and then like trying to get half the record done. And like before they get back, cause I know they're sitting in that little room judging me. Yeah.
Yeah. That's the for vocalists and especially in hardcore, anything aggressive, that's the other circle of hell. There's the isolated vocals. And then when someone from the, from the boardroom or whatever, does the talk back, and you can hear your band members talking.
Jesus
in the
Christ,
and,
this fucking guy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or like you could tell that they haven't been paying attention in any capacity, but you're looking for some sort of validation. You're like, is it good?
Yeah.
And then they're like, you hear them talking about, burritos.
A text or something. Yeah, totally. That's very real. Yeah. We're in the same reality, man.
Oh my God. Absolutely. So, what I'm assuming Basket Case and you know, not to put the band on blast, as you're saying, please don't seek that out, but I'm assuming that was probably like a demo cassette, wasn't through a label or anything like that. So was Left 4 Dead your first experience having like physical media, like a 7-inch?
Yeah, it was the first thing that was like a record. Yeah.
And I mean, from what I know of you, you're someone who appreciates physical media, obviously. Was that something that was like a really high point for you, like getting this on vinyl for the first time?
It was pretty exciting. Yeah. Cause I was a record person and, it was pretty neat to know. And that's kind of the beauty and the magic of DIY punk, hardcore, whatever it is. Like it just your culture that you can, I don't know, reciprocate the things that you feed off of, you make them. And then someone later on tells you they grew up on your thing. And then it's just the circle of life, you know? So yeah, it was totally really exciting. And the Buzzsaw came close after. So it almost immediately went to like really ridiculous, like let's make this wild as we can.
That was going to be my follow-up here, is because, you know, as someone who obviously I love records is so much, and like that was one of the coolest when I started getting into punk and hardcore and stuff and buying that stuff, especially on vinyl, when I found that record, I remember I was just like, this is the coolest fucking thing ever. Like, how did you, especially at that time, that was like that was such a creative thing that I don't think I ever saw any other bands doing at the time. Was there a band that you guys were trying to emulate that did stuff like that? Or did you just figure it out?
The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the movie, the band.
Yeah.
No, we just wanted, and we were really fortunate too, because No Idea, they were just great people to work with, and they were up for wild shit. And it's like worlds away from our thing, but they did like that Less Than Jake 7-inch in a pizza box. So they thought the same way. So we wanted it to be like a picture disc with blood splatters, but something about the picture disc and the die cut of the saw blades would have like melted it wouldn't have worked both. Mm. So we had to kind of like, just pick it and put it on the layout.
Had you seen any bands do any sort of shape like that though? Like something as rigid as that? Like that seems like it would have, I mean, especially again at the time, like it was, I feel like so ahead of its time.
I had probably like a Wasp record or something like 80s things like that, that it grew up on.
Yeah.
They used to make all kinds of like really dumb 45s, you know, Bananarama would be like shaped like a bus or something. There was, I don't know. I knew about die cuts like that. And I think there was maybe it's a Wasp. Maybe I Want to Be Somebody. Or something like that. Maybe that was like a saw shaped, but at that time we were really big on the Texas Chainsaw, the Saw is Family. I don't remember if that's part two or three. That was a big inspiration. So that was okay. Part of it too. Like a, saw.
Yeah. It's one of the coolest like split 12 inches that I think you can find, especially because it's, you know, two great bands doing it. But like, yeah, that really caught my attention, because obviously Ruination did the shape of the U.S.
The USA
well,
thing,
which,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, which was basically like, when you look at the construction of that would have been basically, isn't it just like a 7-inch kind of, is it like a 7-inch in the center, but it just has the shape built out
That's
around
right.
it?
Yeah, and Mark McCoy was really down for like over the top shit
getting
like
weird.
That too. Yeah, getting weird. So it was pretty perfect. Yeah.
Was Left 4 Dead the first band that you toured in? So was that your first tour?
Left 4 Dead hardly left Southern Ontario. We only.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, that's why it was so funny when all those reunion things happened that we did so much, because we never hardly went more than a couple hours from home. And it was very short lived. It was, it was like a year and a half of crazy. And once in Montreal after Jeff had moved away to Florida. So, yeah, no, we didn't go far. The Swarm was really the first band that
the first band that
toured. Places. Yeah.
Because I've followed so many of your bands, but there is that era there, like Left 4 Dead through to Burning Love. There's so much you're doing in there that I don't know that I can keep. I don't even know if you at this point can keep track of which one started when. And like, Because I know there were a bunch that were happening at the same time.
There was at one point three. At one point, I was in university with a double major, working multiple jobs, and the Swarm, Ruination, and Countdown to Oblivion, which was all just like local kind of friends, but we toured as well. They were all happening at once for a bit there. Yeah.
What do you attribute that to? Is it something? Are you just like, is it either A, you're bad at saying no to friends saying, do you want to start a band? Or B, you have new things you're trying to explore, like topics you want to sing about. Like, what for you was the influence for starting all these bands at that time?
I think it's just the way we all sort of did things. Like, people did that in the 90s. In late 90s, especially, like, you would just be hanging out with your friends and you'd already have something on the go and you wouldn't really think, like, well, that's my band or my brand. It's just like, you do another thing and it, like, you play the drums and I'll play guitar and there's your new thing. And yeah, unless you limit it, you could just keep going on infinitely. The Fest era was full of things like that and people that played in so many different configurations. Yeah. So... Yeah.
Is there anything in particular that you like miss about any of those bands where you're like, oh, like there was something very specific about, say, like Ruination that was unlike any of the other bands?
For sure. Well, Ruination, we weren't trying to be like postmodern or experimental about it, but we got together. Ebro was in Chicago and I was here, and we were mainly went to Ann Arbor where Andy was, because it was kind of the middle for all of us. And we played a show the night that we first got together to practice.
Are you serious?
So, like, we wrote songs and went to a different part of the same building and played them. And then, like, that really set the tone. Like, well, fuck it. It's hardcore. Let's just go. Yeah. So the stuff that's on that very first stuff, which I think is probably like that Mark McCoy and the 7-inch we did ourselves. A lot of it was just like on the fly. And that's kind of how we thought of that. And Ebro was in like MK Ultra, Crudos, Charles Bronson, probably a lot of them at the same time, you know, and other bands too. It was just like that.
Did that band play many shows?
Ruination?
Yeah. Did they play, you guys play many shows?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. It's weird. Yeah. We did tours. I found a poster for something and it looked like it had like 60 dates on it. Like, why?
Oh my god,
why would we do it? It was somewhere Black Flag, like work ethic, punk work ethic obsession that we thought, like, if you don't hate your life, you're not doing this right. And that carried all the way through to Cursed, which just burned the whole thing down. But yeah, I don't know why we did it. It wasn't fun. It could have been like it could have been like six good shows. It was like 38 for like, why? Yeah,
it's so fascinating because like the band didn't put out an LP. You know, it's like you guys just had a couple 7-inches. Yeah. So like,
we went on tour to Europe before we even had anything out, I think. I'm not even sure we had this any 7-inch. Yeah, it was, I don't know.
But at that time though, would you say that the Swarm was the more sort of like quote unquote serious band? Was that like, cause you guys had an LP-ish and things like that? Like you were, had a few 7-inches, like was that the band that you were putting more effort into, or did it all feel about the same?
That's probably fair to say. Yeah, like we started the Swarm and Kyle and Matt from Grade, I mean Kyle and I kind of started it together. They were getting really busy with Grade. It's often blown way out of proportion because we're friends to this day. It wasn't like any great, you know, like fallout, but they had their band and we all lived in a house, the rest of us, Adam that played guitar, and our friend Lou, who is from Boston, who's around those Bane kind of guys, who played in that band Barrett before, and he dated Alex from Akrit, and I lived with Alex. We all lived in a house, so we just kind of wanted to keep going. So the Swarm, it became like there was a secondary lineup that was with Lou and then Christian, who was from Left 4 Dead, and I'd known him since we were like 15 years old. That probably was the more serious of all of them. Like Countdown was really fun. It was just some people in Toronto, friends who wanted to do some like Hesher shit with hardcore. And we did. It was really fun. It was just a bunch of us being kind of stupid but opinionated. And we did one tour to the east coast of Canada and back. And didn't do too much more than that. But yeah, the Swarm was probably the more, I don't know, not serious, but yeah, we wanted to like do more with it.
So do you remember which band it was that maybe did like let's say like a full, what was the first band that you went to the US with, like, and did maybe a full US with?
Well, the earlier Swarm, we did some weekends, like we played Wilkes-Barre,
okay,
with Kyle, like early on. We got kicked out of a Wilkes-Barre fire hall for letting off fireworks in a fire hall, which in hindsight checks out. And yeah, no, it was okay. We did a couple things like that. And Syracuse, we played a one really interesting show that was like a very early, Botch Jesuit, and one of the first Dillinger Escape Plan weekends, I think.
Jesus, we're all at the
West. You've probably played the Westcott Community Center in your time ever. Little,
I don't know if I did.
Little DIY like hall, a community hall in Syracuse.
Okay. I played there.
Ryan that did Hex Records.
Sure.
Canavan, and he's still going and he's still great. Yeah, he was putting those shows on then. So we did that, but then the Swarm 2.0 was the first band that like went away for like a week or more at a time, week or 2 weeks. And we went as far, we went to the South, like Atlanta ish, and then kind of wove through to, I know we played Chicago. So for us, that was pretty big, you know, for not,
yeah,
really we've gone to fests and all those. We've traveled like on our own to the fest years for sure. But like as a band, that was the first thing that did that.
Were you somebody that took to touring pretty quickly? Did you enjoy it? Was it, I mean, I know you mentioned how hard they were and like how tough that stuff was, especially I'm assuming at that time, even tougher, just, you know, not as convenient as it is these days with like,
we had an Atlas.
Exactly.
Actual Atlas. And we often didn't know. And we just had to go to a town and look for kids that look like punk kids and like, where's, you know, the kill time.
Where's totally, style, yeah. Like,
excuse me, where's style like 13 from here? Yeah.
Exactly. Like genuine ask a punk, not just like the silly for thing real to put on your Instagram. You have to genuinely ask the punk where the show is.
We didn't all have phones yet. So yeah.
Exactly. So, but yeah, like, did you like touring?
I did like that. Yeah. And the Swarm, I actually like, yeah, there was some pretty intense times and we were on terribly bad behavior out there in the world. And we kind of treated that band like a street gang, you know, like in the Murder City Devils way or something. Like we just liked the idea of that. Like, let's, I don't know, but we were pretty lightweight. We weren't trying not to actually be that shitty, but we just would just fuck around and get into trouble all the time. There was a real running theme where something would be happening and the van would come tearing around the corner and so the door would open like, we got to go now. And I got in the habit. I'd be like on the last payphone in Civilization, like breaking up with my ex for the 50th time in a week and just like leave it dangling and run like, I don't know, but I trust that this is a thing. Let's get the fuck out of here. And you could tell me on the way. A lot of really ridiculous shit happened. A lot of it with fireworks. We were in another country. Yeah. It was fun as hell. It was really fun.
What about maybe going to Europe or the UK? Like what band was that? What was that first time?
Ruination went with Blood Pact, which was Andy's other band. So he was doing double duties the whole time. Andy had played in Earth Mover in different bands. That was like Andy that did Plus Minus. He was the one from Ann Arbor. We went to Europe and that was actually the first probably like a real tour experience was going over there. It was wild playing, you know, squats and it was long as well. It was really long. And there was some really intense things. Like there was the anniversary of, we had to go through Sarajevo and it was the eve of an election. There was something about landmines and this wasn't, I mean, it was really a thing, you know, and it was very eye opening in terms of what people go through and gave me so much respect for the people that run, like there's squats over there. We played some places like Weimar in East Germany where, you know, they would bar the door like a castle at night and the cops are on the other side and Nazis are on the other side and you're sleeping there and you don't speak that language. There's a police scanner or something running like, Jesus Christ, this is a real deal. What am I complaining about in my fucking life? So it was cool like that.
That's amazing. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. I was once told that the people you meet on your first European tour, you're going to know them probably the rest of your career, whatever music you're doing. Do you have anyone that you met on those early days that like you'll still see when you go over there?
Yeah, the Czechs, people from the Czech Republic. My friend Dagmar, that she drove us. Do you know those guys, like Big Tomas and Banana and those?
Yeah. Like Chepitz, like that that crew.
Yeah, that crew, exactly. Yeah, and there's just some of my nearest and dearest, like Tomas especially, and Milan, and a lot of people like that. Yeah.
Oh, that's so cool.
So it's very true. And I still see them, and it's great. If I ever see them, it's just like the biggest hug that's ever going to happen. Yeah.
Another first question that I recently started adding to the show, just I'm curious to hear yours. What was the first van that any of your bands had, and what was that thing like?
Tammy was her name. She was a white. Yeah, it was Tammy. I don't know. We decided she was like just like a high maintenance. She was trashy and high maintenance. We decided that was Tammy. You know, like Cartman, like in that South Park where Cartman's on the show, like the bad kid on the TV on Springer. Yeah. You know, like, you don't know me. You're not the boss of Tammy. Tammy's the boss of Tammy. It was like that. And it was the time when all like the bands overlapped. So Tammy was like white, hollowed out, just cargo van. At some points we were like sitting on like a spare tire, just bouncing all around the back of it. We had a bad habit of buying like $600 vans that were never meant for shit like this and piling them full of amplifiers to drive 20 hours a day. And then like, why are we on the side of a highway in Missouri? Like, cause Tammy's the boss of Tammy. Yeah.
Yeah. The first van that any of my bands ever had was a $600 van that we bought off of a gardener off the side of the road that came with just a gigantic pile of dirt in the back.
Nice. Nice. And then you became the pile of dirt. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. The brown torn up leather seats that were just so hot on your skin in the summer. Like, God damn.
We got the first couch that we saw somewhere. There was nothing in, I don't know how we crossed the border with it, but yeah, I remember we found like a couch on the side of the road. We're like, a couch, and just immediately like, we have something to sit on now. And we put it in.
Yeah. Something I may not realize. What was the band that existed before Cursed? And like, was Cursed starting like maybe the longest time you had away from playing music? Like, it feels like maybe there might have been like a year or two off. Am I wrong?
I actually tried to. Yeah, there should have been, and there wasn't. The Swarm
like,
broke up.
Like you tried to stop doing music for a minute, and then that one brought you back?
Exactly. It was actually, all this kind of ties together, because Ruination was on tour, and one of the last shows... The Swarm was on tour, because this was at the same time. Andy from Ruination covered for Christian on a run of tour that he couldn't do, and we played like Sherbrooke in Montreal, and Radwan, who had played in Ire. He was in an amazing band called The Black Hand that should look that Pulling Your Strings 4 song 10 inch up. It still like blows my mind. And it just was, I broke up with somebody and we still were trying to like live together. It just didn't make any sense. And I just kind of ran away from my problems by going on that really long tour all summer. And then, you know, the arc when you go on tour and it's sort of like good. And then as you're getting more towards home and all the problems you left, like you left them hanging and they're like, oh man, I got to deal with this. So I was talking to Radwan. I'm like, yeah, if I came back here in like 4 days, can you hook me up with like life? Like, could I have a life here? And it was pretty bohemian. And it was like, yeah. And I ended up staying on my friend Ali's couch, who's to this day one of my best buddies. And Radwan, and I worked in a record store with him, and I meant to kind of like walk away from it all. And I think it wasn't very long. It was like maybe 6 months after the Swarm had broken up. And it was like Mike and Christian were in Ontario. Radwan and I were in Quebec, and they came there and we came back. Mostly they came to Quebec and we just started Cursed. Like I tried to stop and it didn't work. So immediately kept going.
One of the most commonly asked questions that I get is, where can I get merch printed? Well, I've got an answer for you. It's Anchor Fish Printing. They are a one-stop merch shop, and if you place an order and mention the First Ever Podcast, you will get free shipping on your order to anywhere in the country. My bands have worked with the owner, Michael, for years, and he even printed the First Ever Podcast merch. I wouldn't trust anyone else to do it. They can handle all your merch needs, from clothing to patches to banners, posters, stickers, you name it. And again, mention the First Ever Podcast and get free shipping on your merch order anywhere in the country. So visit anchorfishprinting.com, place your order, mention the podcast, done deal. Looking for an extraordinary coffee? Look no further than Heartwork Coffee. With 8 years of excellence and proudly roasting in the vibrant city of San Diego, California, visit heartworkcoffeebar.com to explore a wide range of single origin and blended coffees to suit your taste preference. On a personal note, co-founder Rob Moran has played in so many bands that have inspired me personally, like Unbroken and Some Girls, for example, and it's been amazing watching Heartwork thrive all these years. The coffee is amazing, and I'm thrilled to support this company. Once again, visit heartworkcoffeebar.com to place an order. That is H-E-A-R-T, work, coffeebar.com. You know, the first one being on Death Wish, like, had you already had a relationship with Jake? Like, had you known the Converge guys and stuff like that way before then?
Yeah. Like, I met Nate, I mean, much earlier, that Jesuit, like I was saying, the Swarm and Jesuit played right together. I'd met Jake, and Kurt was friends with people in our house, the house, that kind of punk house we all lived at. So yeah, through time, they came up here and played Ontario a lot, early days, like Petitioning the Empty Sky times.
Sure.
Yeah. So we were already kind of in each other's loop as that happened. And the first, I think, weekend of shows we played was Cursed Death Threat, the tough guy Death Threat, not the cool skateboardy one. Yeah. Converge. Yeah. I think that's why they were there as we first played our first show.
So this is before you guys had even, like, did you guys do the demo yet?
We did a demo, I think, ourselves in a jam space, or like Rab1 probably recorded it there. Yeah. Yeah. And it just, I don't remember how. I was like, hey, want to do this? Yeah, sure. We did it. That was it. And I knew Trey actually even longer. Like, I knew Trey going back to like the mid 90s or even earlier. He did zines and stuff. And we used to go, like I was saying, when we went to Atlanta, we went to Philly and we used to go skate with those guys. There was a house that a lot of them lived at. Don DeVore and a bunch of the Ink and Dagger guys all lived in a house together. And Trey lived with them too. Robbie Red Cheeks, a bunch of people that, in hindsight, it was pretty wild. But yeah, and Sean McCabe, all like the Ink and Dagger guys. So yeah, I lost my train of thought. I'm old.
No, I had asked, like, what led you to Deathwish, but that all makes sense because all of a sudden these two guys have a label together, Jake and Trey, two people you've known for a long time.
That's
and
right. Then, yeah.
You know, and that was when Deathwish started to become much more of a household name. Like, I was working at a record store at the time. I was the buyer for like punk and hardcore and stuff. So like anything Deathwish was doing, I was always stalking.
Yeah.
And I remember when one came out, just being so stoked, like just looking at the cover of it and just being intriguing, you know, like no band name on the cover, just the symbol, you know, like this design. And also just being so taken back by the sound of it, because I don't think I'd ever heard a record that sounded like that before. And like, it sounded like it could have been recorded in like a tin shed, but in the best way possible, you know, like it's like so metallic sounding, but not like metallic hardcore, but just like, it sounds like metal, like the actual physical form of it, you know?
That's I've never heard someone say that. That's neat.
Yeah. And something that I don't know if you have an opinion on this band or anything like that, but something that I've always found so fascinating, Chris, is that one of my all time favorite bands in the entire world is the Weakerthans. From Canada,
obviously. Yep.
And there's multiple people that have worked on your records that also worked on Weakerthans records around the exact same time.
Yeah, Blurton, Ian, the producer. Yeah. Yeah, I actually did the vocals inside some little, like, I think it was like a little coffin-like thing that's actually made for guitar cabs. And I think it's where the Weakerthans, it was something to do with like the way the Weakerthans had. Yeah, it's Canada, man. It's like a terrible, it's a lot like the stereotype where like there's seven of us up here and we all know each other. It usually is the case. Yeah.
And just out of my own fun curiosity, do you have any, have you ever had any connection with anyone from that camp at all? Like the Weaker Thans at all? Like, is there any crossover there at all other than just people you've worked with?
Left 4 Dead played a show with Propagandy.
Okay.
And we were dicks. We played a show with them and we just spent the whole thing making fun of Fat Records and Snowboards and all their merch. And I think it's just, we were very contrary. And honestly, like, to be fair, yeah, too, it seemed very like checklist. They had the shirts that were like anti-fascist check. Like, of course those things go without saying. It's not arguing those things. It's just like the merch version.
Yeah.
And we knew the people that were buying them. And it was like, maybe I know those people from those bands. They meant every word of what they were saying. They're very sincere.
Yes.
But yeah, I think it was more like the phenomenon of that stuff was not as sincere as they were. And I think in hindsight, okay, I think that's a pretty good assessment of it. So yeah, over time, I got to apologize a lot. And well, that's Propagandy anyway. I know they kind of cross over a little bit. The Weaker Thans, not as much, but it's a very small world, so everyone's connected. And Ian, the guy that produced those first two Cursed and the first Burning Love, he's kind of like a Canadian Billy Gibbons. He's great. He's just like a rocker. I drove his band across the country a few times.
Oh my God.
Yeah, he's terrific. So
yeah, I think his credit, I mean, at least on Discogs or whatever, I feel like his credit is like, it's maybe One and Reconstruction Site back to back. And I was like, those are two of my favorite things, but they sound so wildly different from one another.
For
that
sure.
It's just awesome.
Yeah.
You know,
there was a band called Bionic here and Ian played on a couple of their records and it's, yeah, awesome. He's great. He's just, he just gets the volume. He's very guitar heavy and he understood it. So,
yeah. I'm forever thankful that I was able to see Cursed as much as I did, because I feel like I got to see you every time you came to the West Coast. Cause I remember I saw you with Breathe or Resist for
sure.
Oh
wow. That was probably the first time then.
That was at Coos Cafe.
Yeah.
And
within a day or two of the Shay.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think I drove down to the Shay show for that.
Yeah.
Wow. And I have a very funny memory of, so because I think you guys played with this. So there's a band from my hometown that you might remember. They're called Bleeding Kansas.
Yes.
Does that sound familiar to you at
all?
Yeah.
I think I did a layout of some kind.
They yes.
Have a record,
that's right.
1642, something with a year.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I remember. Yeah.
So those guys were like very instrumental in me. Like the drummer of that band was the reason that I even got into buying vinyl. Like those guys are like very important to me and Touche in general, right?
That's cool. Yeah.
And so we knew them really closely and all that. And I think they opened up that show as like the local, I think. And I have the most hilarious memory of as soon as you guys finished playing God and Country, Mike, their bass player, just yelled Paging Dr. Breakdown, which leveled the entire place. Like it was actually like a good heckle that just actually landed.
That's awesome.
It was like as soon as the song ended, it was like, "Wow, Paging Doctor Breakdown."
That's wicked. I love it.
But yeah. Anyway, you know, it's this is one of those bands that, yeah, again, I feel very fortunate. I understand things and all of that. So it's just, you know, it's a time and place situation. Was it hard for you after that breakup to then get motivated to do Burning Love?
We already were.
Oh, fuck. It had already started.
Yeah, it had already started because some things had started to go kind of south. Like as they were going up on the outside, they were going down on the inside.
Got it.
Yeah. And like, I really, as weird as it sounds, I wouldn't entirely change the story if I could, because like the way we did it and how hard it was on ourselves, like it wasn't because we were trying to, it was just like the only way we knew how to do it. But also that really made it what it was. Like we were so fucking frustrated with ourselves and each other. And that day, by the end of that day, all we could do was play our fucking balls off. And we were almost playing like at each other, you know? So
it
was just like nonstop. Yeah, it was crazy. And yeah, it was hard. It was hard. Burning Love was supposed to be something kind of different, you know, because of what that was.
with, because you've done, you know, and even more bands since then, like there's Mature Situations, there's is Oxygen, because Oxygen Tank is newer, is that still together?
It was kind of a one-off. It was mostly Morgan from Hive. Yeah, I think so. Yeah. And Hive is amazing, and they're friends, and they're still going, and they're great. And Morgan's an incredible dude. He did it all. Like, I can't. I just had to, like, scream over it. But it was good because it happened during the pandemic. Because the last thing, like, Sect was still out in, like, mid-March 2020 on a weekend with Hive. Yeah. So that was like the last thing that happened before the world shut down. So was having kind of a rough time of it. So Morgan doing that was like, yes, please give me something to like sink my head into right the fuck now. And it took a while for me to get it done because I got injured. But yeah, it was kind of a one-time thing. I have a bad habit. Like, I'm really bad at saying no to stuff, but in that case, that it was awesome. And Morgan's great. And he, like, his frame of reference for that was like mental and things like that. And I was around for that. I could connect with shit like No Justice that I loved. I understand the time, but for me, I just like gotta just do it. I'll just give me whatever and I'll just do whatever to it. But yeah, so I don't know if I did it exactly like he was trying to go for, but I was really happy with it. It was really fun.
You guys had announced Burning Love playing a show. Did that already happen? It happened, right?
No.
Is it not happening now?
Oh man, you just broke the news on live television. No. In true Burning Love fashion, after 10 years of nothing, our guitarist Pat, I mean, it's not his fault and he couldn't help it, but he got in a bike wreck. Bicycle accident, like I imagine between school and home, and he broke his wrist and he's in a cast, and he was going to try and do it. And then they gave him the date that the minimum for the cast being on was longer than this. And the we had both lineups were going to be in one. So it was going to be like double loud, but the other people that were playing guitar, they'd be playing songs. They were not in the band at the time of Pat's, and Pat was fine, but they would have been, they couldn't, it was like, they can't learn it all, like to do his actual shit. His sound was really like integral to it. So the timing was awful, but we're going to have to not do it and then try to do it again next year. So it didn't yet happened and it's not gonna,
but you know, hindsight, it could, you know, at least it's not like we decided we'd still hate each other.
Fine. Yeah. They were way younger. Exactly. They're now the age I was then. So they're like one of the
how does it feel, fuckers?
Exactly. Like, see that shit? It's hard. You're bitter and you hate life and your landlord sucks. And you broke up with your girlfriend and you lost your job and then you do it again. Yeah. Now you see why I was a grouchy old prick and I still am. Yeah.
Oh, it's funny to hear you say that because you've always been nothing but the sweetest time I've known you.
You too.
Is it kind of funny to think about how Sect, after all of these bands and everything like that, is the band that is the, like, has put out the most stuff? Like, you guys are about to release your fourth album.
I know. And you know what?
Is that crazy to you?
The first time in all this 30 years of like playing shows and bands and all these bands we're talking about that I've got to a fourth LP. So it's a first.
Right.
It's a first.
Yeah.
First ever fourth LP. Yeah.
There you go.
If a piano falls on my head right now, I'm at peace with it. It's all right.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's still going to come out whether you get hit by a piano or not. Right. It's recorded.
Yeah.
Did you guys record this one with Kurt as well? Kurt Ballou?
This one was kind of the pandemic record. So it was a little bit harder to do like that. We actually did it in a lot of little stages. We did the drums. We all went to Portland and Andy did the drums there in a studio there. And Scott tracked the guitars himself. We did them in all these different places. I did the vocals. I went down there and we did them in, you know, Holy Mountain, that did the screen printing place?
Yes.
And shirts?
Yeah.
We did it in their warehouse. They were kind enough to let us like stay there overnight, did a couple like all-nighters, just like back in the day, and just did like a makeshift thing and tracked it there. And then we sent that to Kurt.
So he mixed it.
He mixed it, but we didn't do it at God City. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, considering that we're quite a few years removed now, thankfully, from the fucking pandemic. But like, what it took this long for it to come out? Because I feel like it's been a minute, right? Was it just like having everyone get the time to like finish their parts?
A little bit of that. And we weren't really sure if we were going to put it out, and Southern Lord in the end is going to put it out. This one, it was a bigger lag than most. A lot of like Andy plays in Fall Out Boy and Scott plays in Earth Crisis. Steve plays in a bunch of bands. Jimmy plays in Undying. It's been harder. Like everybody had to, whose bands are their jobs, had to get that back on track first, you know? Largely, you know, like Andy's whole situation like that. Think about how the pandemic affected, like, you know, like big bands. It was like, it's hard. And he still does things absolutely like a punk kid, you know? But we had to kind of like respect the dates that everybody else had. Earth Crisis has had a lot in the last couple of years. So it just took longer than most. This is the biggest gap in between things I've had in my whole life.
Yeah, I was also curious of that too. But that's a good segue, because you've also been doing a solo project called Unwell.
Yeah.
So talk to me about the motivation for that. Was that, I mean, is it the P word? Is it the pandemic? Was it you're just like, I want to figure out if I can sing and play guitar?
Both. Yeah. It was exactly both of those things. Like I'd always kind of meant to. I'd had guitars laying around that I could like learn my mouth riffs to explain them to a bandmate if it was an idea in my head. But we all didn't know where that was going or how long it was going to happen for. And I had a lot of kind of rough things happen at one time at the very beginning. I had a really bad lower back injury, like 5 seconds into pandemic, just after getting home from the sex shows. I ruptured a part of my lumbar spine. Like I ruptured a disc and it herniated.
From performing?
No, I don't even know what the hell did it, but it was like March or early April 2020. So nothing was an option. And it's the kind of thing, they give epidurals for it. Like that's the only short-term.
That's how bad it is, yeah.
Yeah, they just cut off the bottom half of your body to your brain. And I had to just hang out for like 6 months like that at home. because it was those were the months. It was like 2020. So a lot of things happened. A lot of people were dying. You know, the right wing shit was happening everywhere. And just like, you know, the exact world you wanted to never see getting rubbed in your face while you're helplessly watch the world fall apart. And you're in like physical and emotional pain. And we didn't know how long it was going to go. So like all I've ever known how to do with anything is like some creative artistic thing, whatever it has to look like. And I don't like to ever think too much about what it should look like or be like exactly. So dumb as this sounds, the big catalyst to even doing it was my cat died. And I don't know if you
it's
get
not
it.
Dumb, man.
No, it's not. If you get it, you get it. And I know you get it. But like this little dude walked into our house and became our cat, like literally walked in the door. It was like, I'm gonna be your cat. All right. And it was like 13, 14 years later. And when all that shit was happening, this guy's hanging out like physically on me, just like purring away while I'm just like trying not to move an inch the wrong way on my back, kind of paralyzed. So yeah, like the only constants, you know, like you're watching all like the Trumpy shit happen, like, man, can just one good thing just fucking stay there, you know? It just felt like the world was slipping away, and the things that are good are slipping away, and the things that are awful are just like triumphing left and right. And to be fair, they still are. But yeah, that made like all I could do is like write music, and I didn't even know how to play it. So I'm like, well, fucking figure it out. So we had that government cheese that everybody had at the time, and I was just like, well, get guitars, get all the pedals. Like I'm still a punk kid and I still am really cheap. So it was more money than I'd ever had in my life. Like, you know, apocalypse money or whatever. But I got all the gear I needed and I just started writing songs. And I'm just about to, the same festival coming up that Burning Love was going to be playing, Unwell is going to be playing a first show. I kind of really had it in my head that I had to just, it's my own kind of cross. Like I have to do this myself. I have to record it. I have to write it. And I did all that. And then having a pretty bad like OCD and ADD combo, man, the capacity for whether it's GarageBand or Logic or whatever you use to just like build this crazy house of cards, you know, in your house is wild. It's endless. So I tied it up into crazy knots and there's like five completely different full LPs of music and like over 100 songs. By the time I stopped, I just kept writing and writing and writing. Yeah. To the point it's like, all right, man, stop writing them and finish them. So there's like 190% finished songs and entire
like
records.
Does that include lyrics?
Yeah. Yeah.
Fuck.
Like a discography in one shot. Yeah. Cause I don't have any moderation. Man. See why it's good that I don't do drugs? I have no moderation, but anything. Yeah. So
that's amazing. That actually, if you wouldn't mind me, I mean, not that it's a tough question, but like,
go for it.
You're someone who's always been like, I've always loved your writing, your lyrics, like whether or however you're writing, whether it's like in print or in a band or whatever. Who have always been your guys when it comes to lyrics? Like, have your influences changed since you started writing lyrics in bands, or are there people that are constants for you?
There's definitely constants, like within hardcore or just in general, and
anything that makes you want to write.
Like, yeah.
Who do you get inspired by?
Well, growing up on things like Crass, you know, like really like argumentative left, far left things that are like every song is kind of a dissertation, whether I like it or not. I had to write out something for a press release, and I just realized like, Jesus Christ, no wonder I stress out. This is like 87 paragraphs long and it's one song. Definitely Sam McPheeters. Of Born Against, in terms of it being like, not to just blow smoke up someone's ass, because that's kind of a disservice, and anybody, you know, that whole like any club that would have you as a member thing, like the people worth kind of putting on a pedestal are people that think it's stupid to put anybody on a pedestal, you know, so it's not like a pedestal really, it's just like,
yeah,
that's awesome. I was into that. It, you know, I feed on that and I make something and someone feeds on that and they make something and somebody feeds on that. That's all, you know? But definitely Crass, Subhumans, the UK Subhumans. Stuff like that. Mike Bullshit from Go, Econochrist, like that era of stuff that was like cynical. But I think Born Against is an example though too, because it's like, it's cynical as shit and it's got a good sense of humor, but it knows what it's trying to say. And he really always like it. That guy challenged, like, I grew up in a really religious household, and a pro-life household by default of, you know, before it was my choice to think that for myself. And that was like, in the course of one fucking song, it challenged me personally to like, why are you thinking like that? This is what the fuck this is. And it was like, fuck, of course it is what it, that is what it is, you know? Those are the things that I really always carry, and I think that's sort of what I think when I'm writing stuff too. I'm like, I have to make a case for something that I'm thinking, and it has to make sense, and it has to apply to anybody. And that's why Sect is interesting, because I was playing for the first time, like the Swarm, everybody was straight edge and everybody was vegan for a point and then weren't, and that's fine, and it's, you know, with most people the change happens, and like, I'm not the kind of person that's sober that needs anybody around me to never change or to be me. Like, I have my reasons. They're in my family. They're in my own past. I know why. If there was no such thing as hardcore in my world, that would be the same, you know? So, but I really like writing a song. Like, I like finally getting to write my version of what would be a straight edge song. Cause to me, that's going to be like, it has to make sense to everybody in this room, most especially people that don't even know or care what straight edge is, like a guy wrapped at the bar at the back of the room, you know, like, this is an industry that sucks your fucking life out of you and your money out of you and doesn't give a fuck about you and leaves you fucked. Why are you giving them your fucking so much of you, you know? So things like that. But I think like, but I have to actually make myself, I try not to retread. I try to do things different, you know, and I realize I make like cycles of songs until I get something out the right way. It just kind of goes around. So there's some songs or themes that are just, they go around like a ghost until they can be kind of freed, you know, until I get it right.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. Curse to me seem like, for example, just as one example, like the most religious touchstones, like that, that seemed like your output out the palette to put all of that onto. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, for sure. I was in Quebec and I was really learning a lot of it, honestly, was about like sex and sanctity and growing up with ideas of sanctity and like what is holy and why the fuck that's so deep in my head that it's years after I have nothing to do with it. And I still have this weird like guilt, you know, mixed with kind of like lefty guilt where everything seems like it's wrong and just being like a nerdy, having been a really nerdy, you know, like oddball teenager. Just having to be bold and learn like with respect to the people around you and everything being up front and being sober and navigating the world of like sex and social situations. It's right. A thing, you know, you want to do everything you can consciously and you have to do that with a straight face. And that was something I had to kind of learn. So whether or not it sounds like it, that's a lot of what The First Cursed is about. But,
I feel like I told you, or, you know, do you know that I got a curse tattoo? So I'm going to punish you with this on,
it's okay.
on the air here.
It's okay.
I have a head of the Baptist. Is this Martin?
Yes, I do remember. You did. It's awesome. You know what? That's exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah. It was one of these things where I was like, I one day need to get a curse tattoo or something like that. And it was like, what is something that I care so much about that I was like, I have to find the right one and have it be done by the right person. And
that's amazing. It happened a few years ago. Oh, you're fucking great, man. See, look, I've got a Subhumans Worlds Apart. Speaking of like things that made me stoked, I've got, the same.
You also have a Leonard Cohen portrait, don't you? From Songs of Love and Hate.
It's a stick and poke. I don't know if you can see that much. My friend Alexandra Snellgrove, she's a tattooist and an illustrator. She did it like prison style.
That's so cards sick.
To break. Yeah. Yeah. It was before he died too.
Oh man.
Yeah.
Yo, I feel like I could chew on your ear all night. So I'm going to get this out of the way. I'm going to just hit you with the last question. This has been a fucking blast for me. So here we go.
Me too. Thank you so much.
When was the first time you felt like you were doing the thing you'd been working so hard towards?
Damn, it might be right now. Like I have a weird relationship with satisfaction where I'm kind of driven by the idea that there's something that I was meant to do and I never really got there. Like it always feels like I'm about to turn 50. Like for fuck's sake, how long do you think life is? You know, how many years do you think you have left to get this right? And as this like theoretical thing in the future, I don't know, but I never really feel like I got it right. And I think that's what drives me all the time. And I may never get it right. Maybe I shouldn't ever get it right. But now,
it's funny.
I've
had a few different, you know, I've been, for as long as I've been doing the show now, I've had a few different guests sort of say a version of that, but it's always sort of sounded like they just haven't put enough thought into it. But the way you just expressed that, I think has made the most sense for that answer. Like having that sort of reaction to satisfaction. That makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah. I think it depends what music is supposed to be to you too. You know, like I see the world and see your friends and eat great food and go to record stores you love. Like, great. If that's what that's about, I've done that a long time ago, but that's not the part of it that matters to that is like eating away at me. You know, it's like something I'm trying to convey. Absolutely. Possibly just to myself to make sense of it, to say it out loud. And I don't feel like it makes sense yet. And maybe it never will. And that's fine.
And that's okay too.
Yeah, because I'm like 30 plus years into playing shows and playing in bands, and I'm about to do this thing where I'm basically like a 15-year-old at a second guitar practice, terrified to stand up in front of a room of people and play a guitar and try to sing at the same time. It's stupid. It could go terribly bad. It's scary.
I'm so excited to hear how that goes. It's totally not the same thing, but I had a bucket list thing of doing stand-up, of trying it, and I did it, and this was like many moons ago now, but like, that to me was the scariest thing I've ever done. And that is probably as close as like what you're about to do as it gets. Cause it's like you by yourself with a guitar in front of people singing in a way that you're not normally doing it. So I commend you, man.
Oh, truly. Thank you. You know what? Reading poetry and literature, did a reading tour. There is nothing like in a band. You're like, escape into the dark and flashing lights and loud, you know, like the chaos.
It's loud. You have people, you have your boys with you. Like, whatever, you know,
it's terrifying is like a 25 minute story in a, like a cafe in a room of people just like looking at you, like we're standing here now, but you don't know them. And, you know, it takes a long time to get around to the point and it could go wrong in so many ways. That's scary.
It took, the fact that you've done that too, I commend you. I'm a really bad, it takes me back to like giving book reports in school. Like my eyes go ahead of the words and like, I get really, my eyes just like jump ahead because of anxiety. Like, did you deal with that?
Totally. And that you're really conscious of the whole room looking at you. You just start fidgeting, man. And you're aware of it in real time. And if you just have to, I don't know why I do that, because it's like, it makes me so anxious, but just throw yourself into it and just figure it out. That's all you can ever do, right? That's all I'm still doing. Yeah.
Chris, this rocks. Thank you so much for doing it, man. I had a blast.
Honestly, I love you. And it's so good to fucking talk to you, man.
And that is our show. Thank you so much to Chris for coming on, and thank you for listening. This episode was edited, produced, and made to sound so fucking good by my boy, Ryan Rainbro. Shout out to Ryan. And reminder, there is a bonus episode available right now where Chris answered questions that were submitted by subscribers. You can get access to that by finding the link in the episode description or simply going to patreon.com/thefirsteverpatreon. And do not forget to subscribe to the show on Spotify, Apple, wherever it is you are listening to this. That's it for me. Take care. Be good. Bye-bye.